right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and tonight we're joined by an illustrious panel of experts at the dummies level. first of all, we have Glenn. Hey, Glenn.
Hello, John. Good to be back.
Thanks. Good to have you.
Thanks.
And then we have the intrepid Tom. Hey, Tom.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Hey, and then here in the Den of Iniquity in the studio, we have Rich. Hey, Rich.
Howdy.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. So tonight is another in our long-awaited series of Dummies broadcast. Of course, the dummies are us, and we're here to talk about a particular document or segment in Mormon history. And tonight we are talking about the manifesto. I kept calling it Manifesto Number One, but it's generally known as the Manifesto. And then in the Doctrine and Covenants, it's called Official Declaration One, if I remember correctly. So Manifesto One is
where does it get the name Manifesto? Because it doesn't really even say Manifesto in the Declaration One, does it?
You know, in the research I did, I never bothered to look that up, where it gets the name Manifesto.
It gets referred to later as Manifesto, but I never saw where it was called Manifesto. I don't know.
It's called the Manifesto in all the literature. And I don't know where that name came from.
Yeah, the news
this
articles
is why we
were,
call it for dummies.
Right. The news they called it the Manifesto from the get-go, but I don't know why.
I don't know either. It sounds cooler than it is. All right, so let's start and talk about some of the. First of all, of course, for those of you who are listening on a delay, we are broadcasting this live via Ustream.tv. If you go on there and search for Mormon Expression, you'll find our channel and our upcoming broadcasts. You can actually call in live via Skype if you install Skype, which is free, and search for Mormon Expression. Become Mormon Expression's friend. You can either call me or you can text me during the broadcast, and we will bring you on to chat with these famous individuals, the Glenn Oslin and Tom Perry. Famous. You can chat with them live. You can also, if you're in the Lehi, Utah area, in the big UC, you can come and see any of our broadcasts live, even the ones where we're naked, but, you know, no one comes to those. And you can come here to the studio and see us live. You just need to send me an email, john@mormonexpression.com, and you can figure it out. And then the last thing is we're starting to, let you know about our live event, which will be August 6th in Salt Lake City. Mark your calendars. That'll be a fun time. All right. So the dummies. So I think I already said that we are the dummies, and we're going to try to break it down. There's two big threads in Mormon history that are really important. And really shape Mormonism from the beginning to the end. Is there an end? and that's the temple and polygamy. And they're both really hard to deal with because they are so complicated and they have so many moving parts. And, with this one, with the manifesto, we're going to try to insert ourselves right into the middle, which is really the pivotal event in Mormonism, in my opinion. And the sort of the pivotal event in polygamy. So there's a lot of background to this that we're just going to have to rush through. I mean, as I was taking notes, I don't know about you guys, but I kept saying, oh, we need to do a podcast on that one, and we need to do a podcast on that one. And, you know, we could do a whole podcast just on the Edmonds Act, you know, alone.
Yes.
And, so we're going to have to sort of rush through some of this stuff. For those of you out there listening, if you have questions or comments you want to chat those, and, I'll try to read those or one of the other guys. You guys looking at chat?
Yeah, yes. I'll watch the chat. Yeah.
All right. Thanks. All right. So let's start at the beginning. Polygamy. Where did it come from? Where did it come from? yeah. Who wants to start with that one?
Well, maybe. There's different. Isn't there different differing theories on where it actually originated from? I mean. Joseph Smith officially started it.
You're not going all the way back to Abraham?
Yeah, Mike would be disappointed in you, Tom.
I guess I should have. Yeah, you're right.
And wasn't Adam married to both Eve and Lilith?
Well, right, Lilith was first. Lilith was first. She got rejected because She wanted to be on top, and Adam said no.
I'll just let that one ride. All right.
That's the story. I'm not making it up.
So polygamy started by the best of our accounts sometime in the late 1830s at the latest, and possibly earlier, depending on if Fanny was...
Right, 31 or 34.
Yeah. If Fanny was just a dalliance or if he tried to marry her. So around about 1838, isn't that when Morgan's wife, he married Morgan's widow? I don't know. I can't keep all those names straight.
Harris.
By 1842, it was in full swing in Nauvoo. And then 1852 on August 29th is when Orson Pratt was given the task of coming out publicly. Now, I think almost everybody in Utah, you know, once you got to Utah, you realize they were practicing polygamy. It wasn't a secret. But 1852 is when they came out to the public, and usually by public we mean the British saints, because there was this conveyor belt of fresh meat going on from Britain to Salt Lake, and you know, there were denials in the British Mormon press that it was happening. They'd come to Salt Lake, and it was like, surprise, you. Glenn, you let my conveyor belt of meat comment go by.
Yeah, I thought about it, but I'll just let you roll with that.
All right. So 1852, they come public, and it, of course, raises a lot of concern. Now, there were rumors of polygamy going on from the beginning. I mean, from like 1831, 1832. So the federal government starts taking interest. There's a lot of talk about the twin relics of barbarism, which were, of course, slavery and polygamy. But then the Civil War broke out in 1860. So that kind of put a somewhat of a damper on federal action on getting the Mormons to quit the polygamy. And you know what I think is funny is I was reading through all this stuff. All the arguments that the Mormons at the time used against the federal intrusion into polygamy, man, they're the same arguments all the arguments that the Eastern press was using against the Mormons, the defenses the Mormons would have. You just flip that whole thing around. You have the Prop 8 debate. Somebody wanted to make a really sort of clever, like, Mormon pamphlet to aim at the Mormons. They could make a position paper against the Mormons today by just using quotes from prior prophets, seers, and revelators.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned at the beginning, John, that there's so many different threads that we could turn into a full-blown podcast. And, you know, we could do one about Orson Hyde and about the arguments that he used for polygamy. We could do one about the seer and all these things that he published in the seer. He took one argument where he used Henry VIII as a justification for polygamy and saying even back with Luther and Protestants breaking off from Catholicism, the Lord was trying to restore the proper way of marriage, and Henry VIII is a way that he was trying to do it. So there was a lot of justification that was going out, and I wish there was a word other than polygamy that we could use for this, because polygamy has undergone such you know, pejoration. There's so much negativity around it, and they didn't use polygamy. You know, they were using words like celestial marriage and new and everlasting covenant, that things that meant more to them. But I mean, obviously today those words mean things different in the Mormon church now, so we can't really use those either. But it really meant a lot. And as we get closer to the manifesto and seeing the impact that it had on the members of the church at that time, I think it would be nice if we could use a word that wasn't quite so negatively charged as polygamy is, if we really want to understand what it meant to the saints at that time.
That kind of plays to the whole, one of the main problems of the whole thing that we talk about here. Everyone says, you know, it's plural marriage or it's celestial marriage, but it's, right. You know, everything is shaded in a different language at this time. You know, even the manifesto, when it begins, it says, you know, to whom it may concern. And I think half the audience, you know, then turns their ears off, you know, and that's, I can't think of a better example than maybe the early polygamy in the church of something that was set up that couldn't be sustained and that would fail. You know, it kind of, I don't know, it just didn't really get a good start, in my opinion.
Well, you know, it was failing all along. And let's see, my book, Van Wagener, I want to give credit where credit's due. He makes the point that, you know, Joseph, near the end of his life, backed away from it. And then Brigham backed away from it. He actually slowed down the marriages because it was always a mess. It just never really worked very well. Now, for the power brokers in Salt Lake, the guys with property and money who could maintain the wives, but you know, out in the colonies, it just was a no-go from the get-go. And you can read the histories, the ones that are still existing, and it was just a blooming mess from one side to the other. And, you know, people talk about the church bringing it back. The church is smart enough. They would never, ever bring it back, ever. It was never anything that came even close to working.
Even if it was re-legalized?
Absolutely.
If the law allowed it?
You would see the church start to campaign heavily to make – well, they are, right? Because I think they're probably more – here's just speculation on my part. They're more concerned about that happening, legalization of polygamy, than they are about gay marriage, because that's a can of worms for reasons we will get into shortly here.
well, see, if you take the position that this was just, you know, Joseph Smith's libido and a bunch of explanations that were built up around to justify it and then, you know, sharing it with other people and it became an institution, then you can say, yeah, it'll never be brought back. But if you're taking the point of view that this was, you know, we joked about Adam and Eve and we joked about Abraham, but if you're saying doctrinally it's still part of the church and it's going to be a part in heaven and it always has been, that's where it gets really problematic. And that's where I think that the literal interpretations, where you still have members of the church that look at it and go, well, it is part of our history, it is part of our doctrine, what do we do with it? That, I mean, I don't know how you hide from that.
Well, no, I think when we get through the manifesto, we're going to see the stage set for the next 110 years,
right,
120 years now, of this sort of non-status that polygamy has.
I don't know if I'm unique. Does anybody else have the same experience? But when I was a true believing member and all those, you know, even returned missionary, I had no idea that we were really going to be practicing it again in the celestial kingdom or in the millennium. You know, just,
really?
It never was taught to me that clearly. And I, you know, and I'd even read through the Doctrine and Covenants. That's just how it was for me.
Yeah,
well, for me, it was one of those areas that not too many people talked about and really thought about, because most people would just cringe at the whole idea of it.
Well, I wasn't taught contrary. I just didn't. I never really learned.
But I think if you really broke it down to the nitpicky, yeah, that's kind of how it worked. One of the things that I never understood when I first was learning about polygamy was that old urban myth or urban legend that, well, the reason why Joseph Smith and Brigham Young took wives is because they were widows and they never really slept with them, and they just kind of gave them some housing and some money. You know, and I just ran with that for, I don't know, 20-some years. That was my explanation. It's
the earliest form of church welfare.
Well, you know, and I think there's a problem in the study of church history. We focus so much on Joseph Smith and those first 15 years of the church, when much of what made us Mormons – happened, you know, over the next 100 years, and this falls right in the middle of that. But because of this problematic history, you know, Joseph Smith is still pretty ambiguous in terms of the stuff that we have, the journals and whatever. You know, you can make an argument, I don't think a very good one, you can make an argument that Joseph Smith never played around polygamy. You can't make that argument in Utah, because they were wide out in the open, you know, with their kids and everything. But, you know, and this is the point I was trying to get to 5 or 10 minutes ago. You know, after 52, polygamy becomes institutionalized in a very, very strong way. You couldn't really serve in a high position without being a polygamist. If you did get into a high position, we're talking like a 70 or a stake president or, you know, in the 12, there was pressure put onto you to marry. There's a case that we could talk. It's probably its own podcast there, of a bishop who was excommunicated for not practicing polygamy. So, you know, it was a serious deal, and a lot of people put it off, but Brigham Young was constantly, and the others were saying, you know, you have to do this to make it in the celestial kingdom. This is the law of heaven. This will never be revoked. This is the way and the path. And it was front and center. You can't read 19th century Mormonism, especially from the Utah period, and extract it from polygamy. It became such a powerhouse of the doctrine. And a lot of people said, I think George Q. Cannon said, basically, you know, you can't extract it from Mormonism, have Mormonism survive.
And John, I remember, you mentioned 52, and I remember when we did the 132 for Dummies, that 1852 was when it went from private to public practice. Do you know how that happened?
It was in conference.
It became public?
It was in conference, then it was published to England. It was sent, they sent it to like Eastern papers and stuff. And you should know that Brigham Young in 1851, I read this afternoon, went before the Utah State Legislature and announced that he had more than one wife. But, you know, the legislature was all polygamous too. So, I mean, I don't know if that was a big announcement. So anybody who came out of Utah
knew. It was just a poorly kept secret.
Yeah, yeah. It was an open secret. And even when they were going from Nauvoo to Utah, you know, in like 46 – you know, there are guys up there with two pregnant wives on either side in the wagon. And, you know, it started after Joseph died, it started coming clear. You know, as women started becoming pregnant, it was pretty hard to keep under the wraps. Yeah. And Master DMJG points out a really good point, which is at the time, not only did they promote polygamy, but they lambasted monogamy. You know, one of the common arguments they used was that they said things like, you know, where there's polygamy, we don't have whorehouses and we don't have those evils. And what Heber C. Kimball famously said, that you find the old men who have young wives and they're spry and have a spring in their step. And, you know, so they said a lot of the evils of society were because of monogamy.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's why we've got so much evil today.
So Sinclair 73 asked a question. I was recently told by my father polygamy was only approved for a smallish amount of church leaders and that it was uncommon for average Joes to practice. Is there any truth to that? I think the only truth to it is that most people were so dirt poor they couldn't afford to do it. And of course there was a scarcity of women when you start marrying up women. Yeah, I think it's funny. If you read through the Journal Discourse, you'll find two types of talks by Brigham Young. One talk where he says, you know, you've got to get multiple wives. The other type says, there's too many single men in the church who haven't married. I don't know why he never made the connection between those two facts. You know, if you're marrying 50 wives, obviously there's going to be a scarcity of women.
And there also was at least if you want to look at it that way, there seemed to be some sort of an elite or favoritism kind of aspect in it all, because occasionally they would use that as like a sign of prominence, you know, if you got more wives. So a lot of the male members of the church back then, that's what they would aspire to. Not necessarily that they would actually achieve it, or their wives would allow it, or circumstances wouldn't allow it. But it was always one of those things like, if you can get that, that's like the end all be all. That's.
Yeah. And we probably want to mention, but once again, this is a whole nother thing. We probably want to mention that a lot of the marriages were dynastic in nature, meaning if you trace the inner relationships between the families, it was very common for, say, one member of the 12 to marry off one of his daughters to another member of the 12, another of his daughters to one of the 70, and there was a lot of intermarrying going on to sort of seal up the internal families. And if you read in, like, Quinn's book, you know, he takes people who are in the Quorum of the 12 today and traces back some of their genealogy, and, you know, and it's still going on today, that a core of the 70 and the 12 come from these dynastic families that were established through these polygamous intermarriages in the early days.
You mentioned Quinn, and maybe in relationship to the question that was just asked, you know, how many people were practicing, he noted that the church had publicly said that 1,300, I think it was 1,300 men were actually prosecuted and served time for, you know, having multiple wives. So if they just had two wives, you know, you multiply that number by three, so you're looking at nearly 4,000 polygamists that were actually caught and actually served time. So I'm wondering what percentage of the population that was.
I don't know. You know, it's hard because the church stopped keeping marriage records and destroyed them, and there's others that are locked up. There's some obfuscation of the details going on there. I know from my family, now my family on all lines goes back to at least the 1860s, sometime the 1830s. The majority of all my lines hit polygamy.
Right.
You know, so, and that, and if you just count, you know, you've got to really count all the kids and, you know, it's, you can play some funky games there by how you count the system because, you know, all those people were living in, if you lived in a ward where there were 20 polygamists and your daddy just didn't happen to marry more than one woman, you were still living it and digesting it. And to downplay and say, oh, it was only a tiny minority, I think is disingenuous.
Yeah. And if you ever want to know some of the problems with genealogy, just talk to some of the old senior missionaries that are working at the genealogical center. I mean, because a lot of the polygamous marriages were never recorded or, like John said, destroyed. So it sure makes a lot of headaches for those old folks that are trying to serve their missions in the buildings.
All right. So
especially if you've got DNC 132 saying that the people that practice this are become gods and the ones that don't serve them as angels.
Want to point out that's a little problematic because DNC 132 wasn't put in the canon until the 1870s.
But
I mean, just flip open a page in your journal of discourse and you'll find, you know, you can go 10 pages forward, 10 pages back. You're going to find a discourse on polygamy. I mean, it was just front and center. It wasn't like a minor issue at all. Polygamy to them was what like modesty is to the church today. I mean, they just couldn't leave it alone, you know. All right. So, let's move forward on the events leading up to now. We're going to have to hit these really fast. In 1862, there was the Morrell Act, which shows you the importance. I was talking about this is in the middle of the Civil War and it was still on their radar. And this is, when bigamy becomes explicitly illegal. And, there's a prohibition in there that says churches aren't allowed to, own property for anything more than $50,000. It's not enforced, but and you know, at the time in Utah, the church controlled. So if you were a bishop in the church, you were also the judge. They appointed you to the legal judgeship. And the legislature was all, you know, the quorum of the 12 and the church had completely by this time stacked all the political offices. And sometimes, you know, members of the 12 held several of them at the same time. So they might be the postmaster general and you might be on the legislature. You might be on the Supreme Court and all that sort of stuff. So Brigham Young had effectively taken complete control of the government. Which is one of the reasons that Johnston's army, you know, was marching out in what, 57? You know, because of that, those rumors coming back that, you know, here they'd been trying to set up a theocracy. And for the church, they were. I mean, they were saying that stuff from the pulpit, and it was really common up to and including the Civil War for the brethren to say, this is the war that Joseph Smith prophesied. The government is going to fall, and we are going to emerge as this theocratic ruler of the United States. And that rhetoric got back from the Tribune and stuff to Washington, and it frankly scared Eastern politicians.
That thought might have not been used by all the church leaders, but there was enough of a, I don't know if I'd say majority of the membership that believed that they were going to take down the United States, but enough of them did that. Yeah, the rumor got back and scared them.
Well, and I think it was preached from the pulpit by enough. You can say, oh yeah,
by
maybe
enough. Yeah,
maybe,
by enough. Yeah.
You know, this guy didn't say it, but we all know how that works. It's not like when Elder Packer gives a talk, you say, well, on average, he's less than 10% of the brethren, so we don't have to listen to that one. I mean, that's not how the system works.
So. Yeah, but that's an apologetic answer there, John.
Yeah,
don't,
it's not a very good
dismiss
one.
It.
at what point did the discussion move from Utah becoming its own nation of Deseret and becoming a state? Because I know originally it was going to be the nation of Deseret.
It was after the Civil War ended. Because then it became clear that the United States survived, the United States was intact, and that, like this, in this Morrell Act in 62, they had, re-put their attention on Salt Lake, that it wasn't going to go away, that the federal government wasn't going to leave them alone. So it was after that they started to plot for statehood. Now, the thing I find interesting about their plot for statehood is, how do I say this diplomatically? I guess I can't.
No way anymore.
I sometimes read some of the early church history, and I wonder if these guys were doofuses. Because they had this plan that they would talk about, like, in conference and stuff. to get statehood so that the federal government couldn't enforce the polygamy laws. And this goes up right up to like 89, right before the manifesto. They were really lobbying hard for statehood. Did they think that Congress couldn't see through their actions? Did they really think that while they were battling the federal government for increasing control over the state and the judiciary and all that stuff, that the federal government was going to say, oh, and here's your statehood? Because they knew rightly that the federal government had much more power over Utah as a territory than they did as a state. But they're plotting to try to get statehood and their bribes. You know, at one time they loaded up a suitcase with $70,000 and went off to bribe Congress. Came back with the suitcase full of money. It didn't work. It just seems so naive.
Go ahead.
No, it just seems naive.
No, I was just going to say, I've read through that. Yeah, it does. I mean, I don't know if I'd call them doofuses, John, but it seems like that they were, did they not really think that their actions were going to cause a problem in their cause to become a state? But,
well, not necessarily. I mean, if this were going on today, it would be that the Lord would provide a way, the Lord would sustain, the Lord would destroy our enemies.
Yeah, I guess that was pretty heavy rhetoric then. They probably thought, you know, they can look past it because we have the Lord on our side.
Now, that rhetoric toned down, but then we start pushing to 1891. We'll talk about 1891 in a few minutes. But I think after the Civil War, like I said before, that really is where that switch came around, that they couldn't just wait for the destruction of the world and to emerge, you know, out of the ashes, that they had to really deal with things. Let's move forward to the next major act, 1879, and this is still a very important precedence. George Reynolds was the secretary of Brigham Young, and they decided to have him be the test case. Reynolds versus the United States went all the way to the Supreme Court, contesting some of the parts of the Morrell Act on, you know, the anti-bigamy laws and on religious grounds. And they basically, the church's argument in the Reynolds case was that, you know, with the freedom of religion, that gives us the right to say conscientiously object to certain laws based on religious principles. And, Chief Justice Waite at the time said something I think is very important, so I wrote it down. This is, Waite says, laws are made for the government of actions. And while they cannot interfere with mere religious belief and opinions, they may with practices. So he's saying the federal government and the First Amendment doesn't really interfere with what you believe. You can believe whatever you want, but it has to interfere with your actions. And he goes on, and say this rule would, that professed doctrines of religious belief superior to the law of the land and in effect to permit every citizen to become a law unto himself. Government could exist only in name under such circumstance. So he's basically saying, if we allow you to circumvent the federal law under religious freedom, then the federal government just becomes nothing, because anybody can profess religion and say, well, I don't have to obey that law because it's a religious principle. And this precedence, you know, played out like in the cases with peyote and all sorts of stuff. And you know, it's been around for a long time. So it was a very important thing in 1879 there. 1882 was the Edmunds Act. And this is where my favorite term comes about, the cohabs, because the Morrell Act just outlawed bigamy, which is being married to more than one woman. The Edmunds Act made unlawful cohabitation. So the very fact that you were living with more than one woman, and, you know, they did duplicitous stuff. You know, they would marry legally their first wife, and then they'd only marry in the temple their second wife. So they'd say, well, we're not legally married. It's something that the fundamentals do even to today. And that's when that was made illegal. It also did things like the exclusion of jurors who believe in polygamy, and the revocation of the right to vote for polygamists, the right to hold political office, and revoked suffrage.
So John, the what you said in that Reynolds case, that Chief Justice, was it Chief Justice, whatever, Waite said about the inability to weigh in on belief. I thought that under the Edmunds Act, that these restrictions were enforced regardless whether an individual was actually practicing polygamy or if they just stated a belief in it.
I think whether
they were practicing or not.
Edmunds Tucker came. That's the one that of 1887, and they just kept ratcheting this up. I think after 1882. I didn't write down the year, but, you know, Rudger Clausen went to prison, and you know, there was many, over 1,000 in prison at some time, but I think that was after Edmund Tucker. This whole thing was a political mess. Let's skip to Edmund Tucker of 1887. That makes it a felony, and it makes the wives are compelled to testify. And if you get caught with the, for doing polygamy, the state could disinherit your children. And all property of the church was, well, almost all the property of the church was confiscated. And, the church was disincorporated with the Edmund Tucker Act. And by this time, a lot of the brethren are on the lam. Between those two, that's when, you know, George Buchanan, was in prison, and, John Taylor had been in hiding for years. And you gotta think about what's going on after 1887. Basically, all of the, now one of the things that the church did underhandedly is they secretly deeded off most of their property to trusted individuals. But all except for like the temple and a few things had been seized by the federal government. People were hiding out in hidey holes. They'd gone to Mexico. They'd gone to Canada. It was just a mess.
It was a very volatile period for the church right there. I mean, this is basically Schism of the Church Part 2. I mean, the first one was when Joseph Smith died, but this period is very, very difficult for the church as a whole.
Yeah, and it's hard to overemphasize how bad it was at the time. I mean, it was really nasty. And I think there was some like moral stuff, you know, like they would teach children, you know, like both Mormon accounts and like the prosecutor saying things like, you'd go up to kid and say, who's your daddy? And they'd say, I don't know. Who's your mommy? I don't know. Where do you live? I don't know. They train the kids to lie. You know, I read about some of the polygamy pits. Did you guys read about any of these? Sort of like Silence of the Lambs holes in people's house where they dropped the polygamists when the raiders came by. I don't know if any of those are still around. I'd like to find one.
Silence of the Lambs holes. Great. Now I've got that picture in my head. Great. Thanks for that.
Tom, it puts the lotion on its skin. Okay. All right. So things were really bad. The Edmunds Tucker Act came out, in the spring, but the feds had seized like control of all the government. They'd seized control of the sheriffs and, you know, there were, you know, probably some nasty thugs going around enforcing things and breaking up families. There weren't very many deaths. I can only find a record of one man who was killed while fleeing from the anti-polygamy raiders. So 1887 in the fall, I believe, John Taylor dies. Now, John Taylor had several, not just one. You know, we've all heard about the revelation that the RLDS and people trace themselves back to. But he'd had several revelations saying polygamy will stand forever. We're not going to give up. We're not going to give in. And he was a hardliner on polygamy. So really that sort of took the muscle out of it. Now, Wilfred Woodruff had always been a big polygamy guy, but he was getting up there in age. I think he was starting to lose the will. Of course, John Taylor died in Kaysville in the Mormon underground. And did they have a funeral for him? I don't know. He was on the lam at the time.
And there were 2 years before Woodruff was sustained, right?
Yeah, and part of that was because some of the brethren thought he was too soft on polygamy. Like it was a real stalemate, and then not all the 12 wanted to vote. You know, they'll get up and say, "Oh, it's always a seamless thing," but there was infighting, and that's why they didn't seat Woodruff for a couple years. All right, so 1889, the Edmund Tucker Act is being appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the property status of the church, you know, I said that they had been disenfranchised or disincorporated, and a lot of their properties had been seized. So that was sort of in limbo as it went up to the court. In 1889, December 23rd, on the 84th birthday of the prophet Joseph Smith, they had a church-wide fast, asking God to intervene on their behalf, to keep off the federales.
federales.
Needless to say, it didn't work. And, according to, Quinn, between December and June, this is important as we start reading the text of the manifesto, Woodruff secretly authorized 23 plural marriages. So it should be clear to note that there were polygamous marriages going on up to 1890, after 1890, and indeed all the way up into like 1904, 1905.
Where were they solemnized, John?
Wherever. And that was one of the problems. That a lot of them pushed to Mexico and to Canada.
And he covers it. When we get to the manifesto, he covers it.
Are we talking about post manifesto polygamy here?
Yeah, that's outside the scope of our discussion today. I just want to make clear that it just never really stopped. I have a note here. The last apostle to take a polygamous wife was Abraham Owen Woodruff in 1901. Remember, manifesto is 1890. In the manifesto, they say, "Hey, we've stopped this already. We stopped it a couple of years ago." And no, they never stopped it. They kept doing it.
Well, that's why they needed an issue a second manifesto later.
Right, and that's why the second manifesto,
I believe,
second manifesto, and then of course John W. Taylor and Matthias Cowley were both disfellowshipped, and then John Taylor was excommunicated for.
But that's not exactly what it says, John.
What? That's not what says.
That we've stopped it.
No, it doesn't say. You're right. You're right. All right, so we're almost there. Now, one thing I want to mention from before is 1891. And this is a whole book waiting for somebody to write. And it'd probably be another podcast, but it's a lot of research. Joseph Smith said some cryptic things. One of them said, if you live until you're 85 or whatever, you won't see the Son of Man. So a lot of people believed that the end of the world was 1891. And in the plotting to send out the manifesto, Woodruff knew that. And a lot of this comes from Quinn again. And maybe I should take an asterisk and put the Quinn disclaimer. D. Michael Quinn had access to documents that no one else has had access to since. He is the only source. Apologists have said he just made stuff up, but the church is sitting on these. So if the church wants to disprove D. Michael Quinn, they need to release these documents to show that he was lying. So that being said, we just have to rely on Quinn because he's the only one who's written publicly about these documents, these notes. Mainly he was able to read, while he was a researcher working at BYU, the minutes of the meetings of the Quorum of the Twelve. And that's where a lot of this stuff comes from. When they were plotting to release the manifesto, they knew that some of the brethren wouldn't oppose it because Jesus was coming in a year. And a lot of people believe that this was right up to the end time, that this would be the last big thing, sort of like in the Book of Mormon, when they're praying and Jesus said, "I'll come on the morrow." I think a lot of them thought that this was that sort of event. The manifesto was just sort of the last thing, that they were down, they're getting kicked, and then God was going to come rescue them.
Yeah. It completely makes sense. I mean, whether there's minutes that are fabricated or not, it just fits the narrative, because the United States is gathered against them. It's right out of the language that Joseph Smith prays about when he's in Liberty Jail. If your enemies are against you in calumny or whatever language he uses against it, the whole world's gathered. They're righteous. The world's going to end. Totally fits.
Yeah, there's two pages out of the cult maker's playbook, and one of them is
cult makers.
One of them is you've got to say the world's against us, and the other one you have to say the world's about to end. So yeah, I mean, how do you break out of that mind trap? Any stupid thing you say, that you say, see, the world's against us.
You keep saying it's not a cult.
What's not?
But it's a cult.
What's?
Never mind.
Glenn, did you just call the Mormon Church a cult?
I said you keep saying it's not, but it is.
I don't say that. It's not a cult. It's culty.
I'm staying out of this.
It's cultish.
He uses all these adjectives instead of the actual word. I'll find a way to make it.
What do you think I am, an evangelical? Why would I call it a cult?
Ooh. I don't know. I don't know why it comes up sporadically like this.
Because it's like I said, it's one of the things that every cult does, because there's I'm trying to think of a polite way to say it. It's a mind trap.
No, you're not.
I like it, John, when you say it's not a cult, it's just culty.
Yeah, cult-ish.
It's McCult-ish.
And there's time, and cult is a function of time, right? There's times the church is more cultish than other times. you know, after they got to Utah, man, it was a cult. During the Reformation, 1857, I don't see how you could argue that it wasn't. But yeah, is the Mormon Church
a whole nother discussion right here?
It is. But I don't like the people argue that the church today is a cult. That's a stretch.
Okay, so 1890.
we were up to 91.
No, we were up to 91 already. 91. Jesus is coming. 91. All right. So 1898 or whatever, or right at the eve of that, then the Supreme Court rules in favor of the federal government, saying that so May 1890, the late corporation, the Church of Jesus Christ versus United States, the Supreme Court upholds the seizure of church properties by the federal government. So this is when the church is getting serious. Around about this time, you know, they realize that they're going to lose, that they've exhausted all opportunities, and they can't win this one. The church disbands the People's Party, which was their own political movement. And this is when the famous story comes that they divided the membership in half and said, "You guys are Democrats, and you guys are Republicans." It was on the eve of this. And there was another law that came out in Idaho, which allowed for the disenfranchisement of Mormons, and it was upheld by the courts. And the Coulomb-Struble bill that was pushing through Congress at that time would strip all Mormons of their citizenship, basically. Mm-hmm. So they would lose all protection under the law. So they saw this one coming down. They said, we're not going to win this one either.
All right. What year are you in now, John?
1890.
Okay. You're still in 1890?
Yeah, 1890. Okay, so now we come up to the fateful day of September 24th, and then we'll get to the manifesto. How far are we all? We are 42 minutes in. All right.
Now we're gonna finally get to the meat of the podcast.
Well, I mean, the text isn't that long. I mean, you sort of have to understand, you know, where this fits in, which leads me to my first point. You know, one of the things the apologists always tell us is that you have to take everything in context. Now, for those of you following along at home, if you open your Doctrine and Covenants to page 291, it's right at the end after section 138. This is the text we're going to be looking at. Official Declaration 1. The first thing I want to point out here is the church has broken form with this passage with the way they normally do things. Like, they normally have a header that gives all sort of historical background information. If you look at all the sections of the Doctrine and Covenants, there is this header that explains the history very briefly, albeit it's a paragraph or two, and gives some of the context so you can understand it. And then there's a summary of the verses. When you get to Official Declaration 1, bang, it's just there. You know, all the stuff we talked about, you're not going to find in your scriptures. You know, even the rudimentary pieces of it, you know, like, why is this here? It's not exactly clear.
Well, it's not stuff that you would think you'd find in the scriptures, but John, it is in the scriptures, dude.
It is in the scriptures. That's true. And the question of whether or not it's scripture has been debated since September 25th of 1890.
And they may have violated the form, but I do appreciate that they put excerpts from three addresses.
Yeah, and then
at the end,
there's another violation of the form. Why? How many scriptures?
What violation are they violating, John? I mean, just the style guide?
Yeah, the style and form that they normally do everything in. I mean, here they've departed. Like, where else in the scriptures have they put inline commentary? So why does it require that? Why can't the prophet write a clear enough doctrinal covenants section like Joseph Smith did that it doesn't require, like, you to take excerpts out of a conference talk given in Logan, Utah, for crying out loud?
Anybody that breaks the style guide acts culty.
It's right out of the handbook, I'm telling you. The cult handbook.
Oh, come on.
All right. So Official Declaration was released on September 24th, and the most of the Quorum of the Twelve was away. It wasn't put to vote And the form here makes you think that it came out in conference. That's not true. Wilfred just sent it off as a press release. He published it in the newspaper, then sent it off to Washington without getting any sort of vote. And that's the first thing that I want to point out here that's sort of an out-and-out dissemblage. It's kind of a lie. If you read this, that's one of the reasons in my mind they haven't put that paragraph there, because if you just read through it, you'll get to the bottom, and it says Salt Lake City, October 6th, because that's when the conference was. But that's not when Official Declaration 1 was released. It was a press release before that. So I think the church here is being not genuine.
Why you say they're not genuine? Because if they could use this document or this text and they could all vote on it later, John, and then they can submit it as a revelation.
What was the point of the vote? It had already been released.
Well, they released it, but then they later voted on it to see if it was an actual revelation, something that could be put in the scriptures.
And you're even saying...
They said the vote was unanimous, and they used past tense.
They're even saying... we'll get there, but you keep saying they.
Yeah.
Aren't most official statements released under the signature of the First Presidency? This one is not. It's released under Wilfred Woodruff alone.
This is the old style guide that they were doing.
Don't you remember the 14 fundamentals of following the prophet? I mean, we've even got like the quote from Wilfred Woodruff right in here in this thing.
We do, that's don't all we? Need. This is where it comes from. Okay, so let's start reading. Official Declaration number one.
Got it.
And this is the best part. To whom it may concern. Oh, where are the prophets of old?
Instead of
thus saith the Lord.
To whom it may concern.
You know what? That's actually the way that the pure Adamic language read was to whom it may concern, but it's been translated through all these different languages. We just never got the real gist of it.
To whom it may concern. Dear sir or madam.
You think verily, verily is better than to whom it may concern?
So this is the most important thing, you know, like polygamy. If you read through, like I said, the Journal of Discourse for all the years before, this thing is – people had, you know, sacrificed everything for this. People had died. Think about Parley Pratt because of their practice of polygamy. The church had given up everything. The family sacrificed. I mean, they lived in poverty and squalor because, you know, they weren't.
But the church was being divided asunder, John. I mean, these were desperate times.
And to whom it may concern. You know, we sometimes lament today that, there's all these questions that we have that are very important that you think maybe one of the prophet would go ask God about some of them. Same thing goes here. You know, and there is some really crafty language we're going to hit here in a second. But to whom it may concern.
So he should have said, "Dear Senator Edmonds, stop, you know how much- stop it with the axe."
We're spending all this time on the very first introduction statement, John. Come on, let's get to this thing already.
This is probably the one or two single most important documents inside the Doctrine and Covenants, and it starts out to whom it may concern. That doesn't strike anybody else as strange other than me. Do I need to pound on this table?
I think you got your point across, John. It is a little bit unsavory, but
all right.
What would you rather it say?
Thus saith the Lord. Yea, verily, in these the latter days, I, God, will give direction concerning the law of polygamy, which I caused my servant Joseph. See, I don't even have my hat in my head. I don't even have my head in my hat, and I can do it.
I mean, this is very, very clearly not the voice of God, and Wilfred Woodruff is not being – it's not. Wilfred Woodruff is not saying that this is God. There's nothing in here. He's saying, this is me. Like, you look in here. There's nothing in my teachings to the church. I haven't been doing this. This is very clearly him. This is me, Wilfred Woodruff, the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He's saying, I'm complying with your laws. He's writing this to the U.S. government. You said he sent this off to the U.S. government.
Right.
Yes, except that later it was voted as revelation. So you say that it's President Woodruff that's saying this, but later, it's actually inspired.
Well, we'll see. Well, let's get inspired. Going.
And hang on, but let's make this point now, because President Hinckley, in his whatever interview with Larry King when that was in the 90s.
Speaking as a man.
Was it in the 80s? Whenever it was. No, sorry.
It was in the 90s. I said he was speaking as a man.
Oh, okay. When he was talking to talking about this, he said that he received a revelation, right? But Wilford Woodruff does say that he received a revelation. It's in one of these three comments.
Oh, yeah.
That the Lord shows him in by revelation what would happen if this didn't happen. But this manifesto thing is very clearly just, I, the president of the church, have not been teaching this. I mean, we can go through the language of it, but I don't see that this is in disingenuous.
He didn't
hear that it should be like a thus saith the Lord thing.
No, he didn't say all that stuff until after he was taking heat. I mean, he just kind of snuck this under the radar, you know,
yeah.
Didn't invite the whole quorum, just
yeah.
Kind of had. I mean, this was all kind of, hey, we're in the same room. We're pairing
up. I get the feeling that John's giving Rich high fives. Yeah, you tell him, Rich.
That's right, brother.
I don't know. I mean, it just seems plain. I don't know.
Yeah. He's just being the president of the church. I mean, we should be giving him high fives.
Hey, Tom, Master DMJG makes a good point for you. So if the members of the church vote later on, it makes it a revelation from God?
According to the modern revelation, yeah, that's true.
That's how we get revelation, by unanimous vote?
That's how it works.
That's you guys know this. I'm not saying anything new here. I mean, if there's going to be any revelation that's going to be enacted upon the church, a prophet or an apostle can say something. And in order for that to become official, everybody's got to vote on it.
Who is calling this a revelation from God, Tom?
It's in the scriptures. When all the apostles and prophets voted on it, and it got put in the Doctrine and Covenants, boom, revelation.
Well, when did they vote on it?
They voted on it.
It was later. Yeah, it was.
They voted on it as a council about a week later in their private meeting, and then they all voted at the conference. But there were some funny things that happened at conference. We'll get to after we get through
that's
the text.
That's not what the voting means. The voting means we're going to support and sustain what our prophet and president has said.
I think the point you can take away from this discussion is it's not really defined what voting is, nor is it really defined in the Mormon church what the canonization process is. Because for anybody who tries to define that, you can find revelations that didn't follow that process. So it's sort of one of those things where they're making it up as they go along.
Not making it up as they go along. They truly believe that the Lord is guiding this ship, and they're just kind of saying, okay, well, should we vote on this? Let's all pray. And when they get conflicting messages, it kind of makes for a mess of things.
Well, I think that most people who stayed in the mainstream church, or a lot of them, believe that the Lord had his hand in, like, ceasing polygamy. But that was just the ceasing the operation of polygamy and not some sort of revelation, as Hinckley misrepresented to say that we no longer practice polygamy. There's no revelation or official statement anywhere that says the church doesn't practice polygamy anymore. You can't find one. It's not there.
Wait, you said no revelation or official statement.
Yeah.
That's wrong. There is an official statement, and it's this.
Well, I said practice.
There is in here a mention of a revelation that he received where the Lord showed him what would happen if it wasn't stopped.
So let's make clear what I mean. There's two practices here. There's the actual going and marrying another woman, you know, by a man, so he has two wives. And then there's the belief pattern of that is the order of heaven and that is the way things are. So the church still has the doctrine of polygamy. It hasn't gone anywhere. So it's in a sense, it still practices polygamy, because you can find things
just,
like men can marry more than one woman if their first wife dies. Women can't do the same thing, you know, that sort of thing. All right,
I agree with that.
Let's read.